Good evening. It is Tuesday, December 7th of 2019. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The U.S.-led pressure on North Korea fractures as China and Russia work for North Korea sanctions relief. This while concern increases as North Korea tests seem likely if the North Koreans don't feel satisfied. A proposal by China and Russia to ease U.N. sanctions on North Korea increases pressure on the U.S. and signals what is the likely end of unified efforts to persuade Pyongyang to give up its growing nuclear and missile arsenal. How serious is this for the maximum pressure sanctions campaign that the U.S. has employed? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's an international affairs and security analyst, Mark Sloboda. Mark, as always, welcome back.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me.
So yesterday, China and Russia proposed that the UN Security Council lift a ban on North Korean exporting statues, seafood, and textiles, and ease restrictions on infrastructure projects and North Koreans working overseas. How big of a problem is this for the U.S. and their sanctions campaign, since Russia and China wield veto power on the Security Council?
The proposal isn't itself a threat, of course, because Russia and China have already agreed to the sanctions. They agreed to the sanctions on North Korea years ago as it started to further develop its nuclear program. And the U.S. also, of course, has veto power on the Security Council, as does its allies France and Great Britain. So they could always veto this bill if it actually became seen as a threat to the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign, which has really been anything but, considering the amount of engagement and FaceTime and seeming personal relations that Donald Trump has devoted to the leader of North Korea, something that no other U.S. president has ever done. But I don't think this should be seen as a threat at all. It's actually, I think, Russia and China trying to push North Korea and the United States gently back to the negotiating table. It's a rather minor easing of sanctions that Russia and China are hoping that them proposing can help a U.S. foreign policy circles opposed to lifting any sanctions on North Korea see past that, perhaps helping Trump accept this over the advice of some of his more hawkish and neocon settlements. In fact, the bill that Russia and China have put forward specifically promotes the U.S. and North Korean dialogue process, and specifically says that it wants to encourage that process to continue.
The United States says it would be premature for the UN to consider lifting sanctions right now and has called for North Korea to return to the negotiating table. Here's what's interesting to me about the US and their reliance on sanctions. Historically, they don't work. I can only think of, off the top of my head, one instance, and that even might be debatable, South Africa, where the U.S. imposed sanctions on a country resulting in capitulation by the targeted country. So, you know, we could list example after example, whether it's Iran or whether it's Zimbabwe. There are a litany of countries where sanctions just don't work.
Yeah, I think sanctions have become a way for the U.S. political and foreign policy elite to express outrage and to, quote, do something, quote unquote, right? Even if it doesn't have any good effect, if it punishes innocent people, it's largely a way of taking action without really doing anything. And it's seen almost as if the right to conduct trade with the United States is something that is given or taken away, not out of any free market principle or anything, because the U.S. obviously doesn't have that, but out of some type of moral approval on the side of the U.S. And it has to be noted that Chinese and Russian patience with the U.S. economic war through sanctions and tariffs and a host of other measures, not only against North Korea, but against themselves and much of the world. Both Russia and China are subject to U.S. sanctions and economic warfare right now. And they are probably not looking very favorably at this moment on U.S. policies, likewise to other countries. There's very little sympathy for that in Russia and China at the moment.
How is South Korea right now fitting into this debate?
South Korean President Moon Jae-in, bless him, he's pretty much a miracle. He is continuing the peace process forward with North Korea on international headlines much lower level, but probably much more substantively, and something that will have much longer lasting ramifications. You know, it's going a little bit below the radar of the mainstream media headlines, but he's continuing to push forward. And if I have any hope of North Korea and South Korean peace, it is between the leaders of the two respective countries. Whether the U.S. decides to continue a peace process with North Korea or not. And South Korea has weighed in on the easing of sanctions
favorably
on North Korea.
On the North Korean side.
Favorably.
Yeah.
Favorably. Its support, well, the Moon Jae-in administration anyway, supports lifting sanctions with UN Security Council approval. So it sees that, it recognizes that North Korea has taken substantial steps and has ceased long-range intercontinental ballistic missile and nuclear tests for several years now, and yet they have seen no reciprocal response from the U.S. with even a token slight lifting of sanctions, which is what Russia and China are proposing here.
In fact, that point about missiles takes me right to the next point. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said yesterday North Korea would likely carry out unspecified tests if they, quote, don't feel satisfied, end quote, amid fears the two countries could return to the collision course they had been on before launching diplomacy. And experts say that North Korea could restart ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile tests, that have been suspended, to your point, since 2017.
Yeah, and North Korea has long warned about this. So they warned about this when, after the meeting between Trump and the North Korean leader in February, talks since then have twice failed through, with North Korea saying that the U.S. is not willing to make any compromises, not willing to lift any sanctions before complete unilateral denuclearization, as the U.S. sees it, which they require from North Korea. North Korea always says denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula, which means with them that the U.S. would cease deploying and exercising nuclear-capable military equipment on their borders. That's the way the North Koreans see the idea of denuclearization. So the promise to restore those testing is what North Korea set quite some time ago. They said they give it till the end of the year. And if the U.S. doesn't substantially return to the negotiation table and in turn give them something for what they have done thus far, then they said, we'll return to it. You haven't taken a reciprocal step. And, you know, that is what Russia and China are trying to avoid here. They are trying to prevent the escalations from stumbling back into the escalation spiral.
And North Korea saying, you have to give us something. The U.S. and South Korea have postponed or scaled down a number of joint military drills. That, to a certain degree, seems to be sleeves off your vest, because when a country such as North Korea is looking for an easing of sanctions and you're just postponing military drills, that does not seem to be a very good trade-off.
Well, actually, they've already traded for that. They ceased conducting shorter range missile tests, right? Missiles that would threaten South Korea or Japan in return for that somewhat haphazard reduction in joint U.S.-South Korean military drills on the North Korean border. And it was followed through on the freeze for a freeze proposal that Russia and China both put forward. If you cease military drills, we'll stop short-range missile testing. And we've seen that. And every time the U.S. and South Korea have conducted a military drill, North Korea has tested a short-range missile, and then it stops again. So North Korea, as far as it's concerned, has already received, taken a reciprocal gesture for that military drills. And it also started to dismantle some of their nuclear facilities already. Again, no reciprocal step from the U.S. on that. The U.S. expects the total and complete unilateral denuclearization of North Korea before any sanctions are lifted. And that's basically their policy at this point. And North Korea is getting a little fed up. They expect this to be a give and a take, a standard trust-building relationship, considering the bad history of the United States when previous presidents fulfilling deals on nuclear with North Korea. And they see themselves right now basically as being presented and thrown around by Trump and his reelection campaign as some type of foreign policy accomplishment. And they don't want to just be a poster for Trump's reelection. Not that I think it really benefits Trump's reelection at all, but they see themselves being used domestically in the U.S. without any real substantial movement forward on the peace and denuclearization process.
Real quick final question, and I'm dropping this on you without having discussed it on the front end, but I know you track everything in the world. So China's new aircraft carrier enters service at a South China Sea base. China commissioned its first domestically built aircraft carrier today at a key base on the shores of the disputed South China Sea. Any insight? President Xi Jinping is overseeing this sweeping push to refurbish the armed forces. He's developing stealth jets, anti-satellite missiles, and launching this domestically built aircraft carrier. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, this is China's second carrier now. The first one was a refurbished Soviet aircraft carrier. And this is the first of what will be many Chinese completely domestically built aircraft carriers. This is only the first one. Keels on two others have already been laid down. And I expect that each one will develop further in terms of capability on the one before it. And this is certainly... China joins a very small list of countries in the world that have more than one aircraft carrier. There's a very small list of countries that have any aircraft carrier. And this will significantly increase China's goal to build a blue water navy and to project power beyond their borders into the Pacific, specifically into the South China Sea.
That's interesting to me, Mark, because things that I have been reading were indicating that the move in terms of a navy was to be Submariner away from the larger aircraft carriers. Is there any validity to what I've been reading about countries focusing more on submarines instead of aircraft carriers?
Now, that would actually be Russia's naval policy. Russia definitely, right now, it has focused more on submarines, missiles, underwater drones, simply because of economic capability.
Oh, so that's not a global move. That's a Russian move.
That's a Russian move. Okay. I mean, it's okay. Not the only country pursuing that. But China definitely is not. China is pursuing a true, following both paths, as it were. They're building plenty of submarines,
gotcha,
and underwater drones,
okay,
and missiles as well. But they're definitely building a carrier-equipped blue water navy.
And do they see that as a prestige move as well as a military capability move?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, there's no question that there is a degree of geopolitical and foreign policy prestige that comes with it. But China's main concern is securing their trade routes.
Right.
They feel that their trade energy routes are very vulnerable to being attacked and disrupted by the United States.
Right.
And they are a nation that, to continue to grow domestically, they are a trading country. They
right.
need those trade and energy routes by sea to remain open, and they need to protect them.
Mark Sloboda, as always, thanks for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is an illegal purging of voters taking place in this country. Yesterday, we discussed Wisconsin. Today, there's even more outrage as Georgia Republicans remove more than 300,000 voters from the rolls. A federal judge last night allowed Georgia to move ahead with a purge of over 300,000 voters deemed quote-unquote inactive by Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, sparking outrage from rights advocates who accused the GOP of an illegal voter suppression effort ahead of the 2020 elections. How is this allowed to happen? Where is the outcry from corporate American media? Well, for answer to these questions and others, we turn to my next guest. He's an award-winning investigative reporter featured in The Guardian, Nation Magazine, Rolling Stone Magazine, BBC, and other high-profile media outlets such as this one. He covered Venezuela for The Guardian and the BBC Television's Newsnight. His BBC reports are the basis of his film, The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. He is Greg Palast. Greg, welcome back.
Yes, and I'm going to plug my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, about how Trump stole the election, which you can now get free on Prime. So okay, that's my last commercial.
Thank you.
Yeah, they are stealing. Okay, here's what's happening in Wisconsin and in Georgia. It's actually the same thing, Doctor, which is they are using a brand new purge method, which my team calls purge by postcard. They say if you haven't voted, that's the fancy term they say, inactive. Doesn't mean you're inactive, you haven't voted, or their bad records say you haven't voted. And then they send you a postcard, and if you don't return the postcard, you lose your vote because they say you have moved away. Now, of course, voter rolls, if you live in Wisconsin, you shouldn't be on the rolls there if you have moved to California. However, here's the thing, is that someone deciding not to vote, which is your right in America, and not returning a postcard doesn't mean you've moved anywhere. It just means you didn't return a postcard or you didn't get the postcard. In low-income communities, especially renters move, students move. In other words, that's the Democratic demographic. And what we found, and I say we, the Palast Investigative Fund, my organization, and the Guardian newspapers that I now work with, what we did an analysis, we took the Georgia voter scrub list, okay, that the people that they're removing now, okay, we went through it, and we've determined that over 70% of the people on that list have never moved from their voter registration address. This is an illegal, racist, biased, partisan purge in Georgia, and they're repeating the same game in Wisconsin, where the people that are being removed are students in Madison and black folk in Milwaukee. That's the target. It's wrong. It's illegal. It's unconstitutional. It's racist. But, hey,
it's America.
On our Supreme Court.
It's America.
Welcome to America.
One of the things I think is important to point out, and you've always been diligent to make this point, is that the postcard is really designed to look like junk mail and to be disposed of, not returned. And evidence of that is the company that designed the postcard is a company that designs junk mail.
Well, here's the thing, is that the design, okay, you look, we have junk mail experts that we hired for the Palast Investigative Fund. And if you see the film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, I show you the postcard. And Brian Kemp, and by the way, Chris Kobach of Kansas designed this card. That's the white supremacist who was the Secretary of State of Kansas. He's running for Senate now in Kansas, and I don't use the term white supremacist. I don't throw that term around a
lot.
No,
sir, you don't. I've known you a long time, and you don't.
I don't. He's an exception. He is really, he's astonishing. So he designed this postcard. It's a big block of black print. Young people, there's no, like, number, phone number. There's no website. young people don't even get postcards and don't even bother filling them out. They don't deal with mail. So you knock out a lot of young people. And like I say, renters and black people don't even get them because they've moved. By the way, you don't lose your vote in America under federal law if you move within your county. We had people in Georgia when we got those lists who moved within their building, but it was not forwarded to them. They moved their apartment number and they lost their vote. Now, who are renters? Low-income people, heavily voters of color, especially in Milwaukee and Atlanta, and where this is where they're targeting. So the card, all right, so you take, as our expert told us, say, take a look at the card that Brian Kemp sends you, which is, if you don't return it, you lose your vote. But he also sends out cards, Brian Kemp, when he was running for governor, which are very different. They're big, they're colorful, it's very clear what he wants you to do, vote for him. It gives you the information you need, it gives you phone numbers and websites. So when Kemp, as the candidate, sends out postcards, he sends them out designed to get a response. When he's sending out cards to his opponent's voters to preserve their vote, he makes it so that it's inscrutable, it's impossible to understand or read, and by the way, it's in English. And we do not have an official language in the United States of America. So it's a direct violation of the National Voter Registration Act, the Voting Rights Act, which, by the way, still does exist.
So how is it in Georgia it was a federal judge, in Wisconsin it was a state judge? How do these judges who took constitutional law when they were in law school, like I did when I was in law school, how is it that they now are able to make these decisions that are directly in violation of the Voting Rights Act and the United States Constitution?
Well, I hate to say it, Doctor. I know you went to law school, but the greatest arch criminals all have law degrees. And one of the problems is we now have, in the United States, we have a judiciary which is filled with partisan hacks. And there's no court that's worse than the Supreme Court. So what happened is, in Wisconsin, I spoke to the great Barbara Arnwine, who you just had on yesterday.
Yes, sir.
Who is a brilliant lawyer and professor of law. And she and I said, you know what? We believe that the team that was defending that, remember that a right-wing group sued Wisconsin to force them to remove people.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that a lot of the lawyers and legal team in Wisconsin was appointed by the ultra-right-wing governor, Scott Walker, who was just thrown out of office. So basically you have people within the Wisconsin government who actually are more than happy to be sued. It's a game that they play. This so-called, this right-wing group that brought this lawsuit to force Wisconsin to remove people, one of their tricks is to find sympathetic Republican officials, sue them, and then the Republicans say, oh, what can we do? We've been sued. We'll just sign off. Yeah, we'll remove all these people. This group has been doing this for years, fake lawsuits to officials who want to be sued. The thing is, Wisconsin just switched. You actually now have, I just actually met with the lieutenant governor of Wisconsin, Mandela Barnes, a very brilliant and militant African-American who is very, very concerned about voting rights in Wisconsin. But, you know, they have to turn around what they were left with, which is just a bureaucracy which hates them.
We have just about 2 minutes. What's the remedy here? What are you suggesting that voters do to address this ongoing attack on our elections, which isn't coming from internationally, it's coming domestically?
Okay, I should say three things. One, spread the word about this ripoff. Get people to listen to Wilmer's program, Dr. Wilmer's program, and that's very, very important to know that the theft is going on. We expose it and we reverse it. The second thing is protect your own vote. One thing you could always do, they purge the voter rolls, especially black voters, young voters. They know who you are and they don't want you to vote. Please check your voter registration. Every single state allows you to check online. And so you go to your Secretary of State or your Board of Elections and just look up, check my voter registration with your state name, type in your name, make sure you're still on that list. And again, 60 days before any election, do that again. I can't tell you, I was at these polling stations in Atlanta, one person after another who is purged, and I had the purge list. And while I'm very sympathetic, it's horrendous to see people lose their vote like this. And people, I have, you know, Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin was removed. By the way, she didn't fail to vote. They just put her on that list anyway. Mm-hmm. But all this could be avoided if they'd simply check their registration. And I know it's crazy. Say, I've been voting in the same place 20 years. I don't care. You better check your registration. By the way, one of the people that was removed from the voter rolls was me. I'm glad I checked.
Wow. Greg Palast, as always, thank you for your time. Let me say again, your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, that fabulous film, and it's free. Fabulous yeah. film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And you cover this in depth. And why this hasn't gotten broader support, I don't know. But The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. As always, Greg, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thanks, man. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. George Conway and other conservatives launch effort to block Trump's reelection. A group of conservatives known for their criticism of President Trump, led by lawyer George Conway, is launching a super PAC aimed at stopping Trump from winning reelection. The Lincoln Project, as it is called, is made up of some of Trump's staunchest conservative critics and represents the first formal operation for the so-called Never Trump movement. Could this become, or has this become, a serious problem for President Trump? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and writer for Citizen Truth, Carmine Sabia. Carmine, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
So the group announced the launch of the Super PAC in a New York Times op-ed today. It was authored by George Conway, former John McCain advisor Steve Schmidt, former Ohio Governor John Kasich, and others. Has the party gotten away from these individuals, or can they mount a serious challenge to the president? And when I say challenge, I don't mean one of them as a candidate. I mean forcing him to fight battles on multiple fronts.
I read that this morning, you know, and my response to it was to brush it off. These guys have been crowing the same tune since 2016. Yeah, I mean, these guys are the same type of Republican, and I use the term Republican loosely, who has been kissing the mainstream media's butt for years, hoping against hope that somehow they're going to get a fair shake and that somehow the media is going to like them. The same media who sings the praises of the late, great Senator John McCain, who I love, sings the praises of Senator McCain when they attacked him in 2008. These people cannot put up any kind of challenge. It's a moot point. It's a moot issue. No, nothing. They can't do a thing.
They wrote that their effort over the next 11 months will be, I found this interesting, defeat Trump and Trumpism at the ballot box and to elect those who they consider patriots who will hold the line. So, A, I think they said they've got $1 million in the bank as seed money. I have not seen the bank, the deposit receipt, so I don't know. But I just find it interesting that not only are they targeting the president, but they are also targeting, when they use the term Trumpism, I'll then say an ideological direction and candidates down ballot who subscribed or ascribed to that ideological bent. Your thoughts?
President Trump is a lot like President Reagan, and here's what I mean. They're not similar per se in their beliefs and philosophies, but where they are similar, where they do have something in common, is the fact that both of them changed the party when they get to power. President Trump has changed the party. The party is no longer what it was before he got there. And to that end, no, they can't. They can't do anything about it. The train has left the station, and they're not on. And their brand of conservatism is over. The brand of conservatism. Let me tell you, Wilmer, what their brand of conservatism is. They like to, what we call, compromise, right?
Mm-hmm.
With the left. Well, let's meet you in the middle. Let's compromise. But their compromises always include caving to 90% of what the Democrats want and getting maybe 10% of what they want. It's been happening for decades. Republicans had enough of it. They finally have somebody who will actually put up a fight, and that's it. It's over. Their brand of kneeling down is over.
Give me some examples of the caving. And in fact, let me see if I can answer my own question. Would an example of that be government spending? That was one of the big complaints about George W. Bush, that he was not a conservative because fiscal spending and deficits got out of control.
It would be, and that's forever changed the party. We can't unring that bell. So now, can't rein in the spending anymore.
But the counter to that would be, what's really been driving up the deficit hasn't been social programs, which traditional conservatives rail against. It's been these foolish military exploits and this most recent $738 billion defense bill. And by the way, $1.5 trillion in tax cuts, which the argument has always been since Ronald Reagan, would trickle down to Main Street, stimulate economic growth, and revitalize the economy. And every economist that did Econ 101 will tell you, as his vice president told us, that's voodoo economics.
Correct. No, I understand what you're saying, but it does bear fruit. Companies that save money hire more people. Those people spend more money.
But that we haven't seen that manifest itself either during the Reagan administration, and we damn sure have not seen it play out since Donald Trump came to office in 2017. Yes, the
consumer spending is up.
On credit. Consumer spending is up on credit. What we have seen, and all of the data bears this out, is, yes, IBM is making more money. Yes, Lockheed Martin is making more money. But more importantly, Wells Fargo and the financial side of the economy is doing well. But they're banking that money. They're not reinvesting that money into manufacturing in this country, which would create jobs, and then people would be spending based upon salary and wages, not upon available credit.
Can't create jobs in a country who is beset by and hampered and hamstrung by mountains of regulations that have been put there by Democrat presidents and Democrat congresses that have to be worked through. And then you have your Democrat-run unions who have driven the wages up so high that people are unhireable. And if you can, and there's certain levels we can't go into. We're never gonna beat China in wages because those people, because of their government, work for slave money. They work for slave labor. So, but we could be competitive. We could be competitive, but the unions have destroyed that.
The unions created the middle class in this country.
Yes.
The unions were part of the element that created the middle class in this country so that you then actually have Americans who can afford, based again upon their wages and their salaries, they can go and buy the products that they make. They can buy the cars that they manufacture. They could buy the televisions, which are no longer manufactured in this country.
Wait a minute.
That's on the union side. And then on the wages side, wages aren't rising in this country. Why? Because Ford is not reinvesting in its workers unless they go on strike and force Ford to the table.
Again, goes back to unions.
Oh, the other point was regulation. You mentioned regulation, which is a constant trope by conservatives. The problem with regulation, the conservative argument on regulation is red tape. It hinders productivity. It slows down production. It's not as profitable. But what gets left out of that equation is, yes, regulation might be a problem on the business side, but there are consumers who are protected by those regulations. And so that's
Some of them are ridiculous.
But see, we hear that argument all the time. And they talk about slashing regulations in terms of forestation, deforestation, in terms of fracking and there are people's water tables that get polluted because of the chemicals that get introduced into the ground and find their way into water systems. Thalidomide babies back in the 60s, opioid crisis. You can't have unfettered corporate expansion and growth without oversight by the government, because the cost element of capitalism doesn't take people's welfare into account.
Well, if people can't collect rainwater on their own property because of regulations. To say regulations are not hampering productivity is a lie.
I didn't say that they weren't. I didn't say that. What I said was that the conservative argument is that regulations hamper growth, restrict productivity and profit. And I concede that. But what does not get discussed by conservatives in that argument is there are consumers on the other side of the equation who are protected by a lot of those regulations that are put in place, hence air quality, hence water quality, hence quality of life. Oh, by the way, the planet is warming and we're all going to drown if things just go unfettered and cars are allowed to emit whatever they feel they want to.
That's only if we don't get the ice age that was predicted in the 1970s.
That's only if we don't restrict emissions on automobiles, as California has successfully done. And now what are conservatives trying to do? They're trying to change California's emission laws, simply not because they have data to show that those standards aren't working and that people's health is improving in terms of lower asthma and other airborne related illnesses. It's that it costs GM a little more to make a car that produces less emissions than it does otherwise.
But because it's pointless. You can't prove to me that the earth is warming. You can't prove to me that we have a cause in it or a major cause in it. Let me ask you a question. We had two ice ages that we know of. Both happened and both got the earth then warmed and the ice ages went away and the waters receded. Who was driving cars then? How did the climate change so drastically back then? There was no cars and no factories. How'd that happen?
Well, I think it happened over time. I think it over a greater span of time than we are witnessing up to this point. I think.
But we're not witnessing anything.
I think this.
We have computer models.
We have computer models. We have storm surge and we have hurricanes and tornadoes, the duration of which and the strength of which we have not seen in over 200 years. We have incredible amounts of data that has been collected over time. We have ice sheets in the polar caps that are melting. We have polar bears that can't find seals to eat because they're out. Well, I'm just giving you the data, man. I mean,
That's not even talking points.
I'm giving you what the scientists are telling me and documenting are happening.
But the ice is growing. Ice is growing in the Arctic.
Maybe in your refrigerator when you put in more ice trays, but it's not happening at the polar caps. The ice
it is though.
Okay, let me ask you this:
The polar caps were supposed to be gone 5 years ago. What happened?
Well, maybe they've moved that time. Well, first of all, some of that has been slowed because of practices that have been taken to reduce emissions. Let me ask you this. Have you been to Glacier National Park in the last 5 years?
I go every day.
Have you seen photographs? Have you seen photographs of Glacier National Park in the last 5 years?
I have not.
Okay. Do yourself a favor and take a look at the time-lapsed photography of Glacier National Park over the last 5 years. And one of the problems, some might consider this minor, is that when you go to Glacier National Park, you don't find any glaciers anymore.
Well, what if we banned plastic straws? You think that would solve it?
No, that won't solve global warming. What that will solve is the plastic problem that we find out in these mile-long, mile-deep plastic beds that are floating in the oceans.
But let's tell your fans the truth. Where's 90% of the plastic in that ocean coming from?
Well, a lot of it is coming from Europe.
Asia.
Well, I was going to say, what I was going to say was, it depends on which ocean you're talking about.
Pacific.
Because the Pacific Ocean problem, that is floating to the United States from Asia. Absolutely.
Correct. Okay, so what I submit to you is not that there are certain pollution problems. Because here's the thing. We can go into the Paris Climate Accords, stand on our head, erect statues of Greta Thunberg, do everything a 16-year-old kid tells us to do. And you know what's going to happen? China's going to laugh at us, keep producing, grow their economy, pollute the hell out of the whole world. And we're going to be sitting here bankrupt, wondering what happened. We can't solve it. That's the thing.
We can't solve it. What we can do is lead the effort towards solutions.
And China's not following us.
And China would be more inclined to sit and negotiate with us if we were actively involved in these processes. Unfortunately, what China does is that China says, well, why should we sign on to accords that the United States either A, violates itself, or B, just reneges on before the ink is dry?
Okay, but let me ask you this then. How many environmental regulations, EPA, environmental regulations, do we have in this country? Has India and China followed one of them? They have people that are starving to death. They could care less about the environment 200 years from now. They're worried about eating today. Well, the only thing we're going to do with all these regulations and all these accords and all this glad handing and back slapping and is hamper and hamstring our economy and our economic growth at the expense of letting China grow. And they're going to look at Beijing. You can't even breathe in Beijing without a mask. They don't care. Their people are dying from their pollution. They don't care. And you're going to tell me that they're going to follow us?
But they do care because China has been implementing programs to deal with the air quality in their country, in Beijing, in their cities. And reports are showing that in some of those cities, the air quality is actually improving.
I've seen no tangible results of anything better happening in Beijing.
It sounds like you got air quality problems in New Jersey.
Well, I'm in New Jersey. And so I actually spoke for fresh air. But I will tell you this.
Yes.
You talked to me about unions before, and I wanted to get back to this. I'm an Italian guy from New Jersey. You don't have to tell me about unions. I know how they started.
Right.
I know who profited from them.
Okay.
I know what they were set up to do and who they were set up to make rich.
Okay.
Okay. They weren't set up for the worker. They were set up for the people at the top of the unions to get rich. It's still happening today. The unions are the biggest scam going, and they've destroyed this economy. They've ruined this economy. That and the regulations.
That, Carmine, we will have to have that conversation on another program because we are up against the clock.
I'd love to.
You know, the one thing I can control is time. I'm a bad, bad man.
Correct.
But the one thing I can control is time. Carmine Sabia, as always, man, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your input. And as always, thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. All right, man.
Thank you. God bless.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Boeing to temporarily shut down 737 MAX production. Boeing next month will temporarily stop making the 737 MAX, its most popular passenger jet, the company said yesterday. The decision, after a two-day board meeting, is the culmination of the worst crisis in the company's 103-year history and follows two crashes that killed 346 people. Boeing had repeatedly signaled that the plane would be cleared to return to the sky before the end of the year. Are there larger problems flying under the radar here? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He is the president of Mackey International, an aviation consulting firm specializing in aviation safety, risk management, accident investigation, air carrier certification, and safety compliance audits, Keith Mackey. Keith, as always, welcome back.
Thank you, Dr. Leon.
So this new model of its workhorse 737 was begun under pressure in 2011 as the company sought to fend off competition from its European rival Airbus. It's reported that Boeing's decision could ripple through the American economy. The company is America's largest manufacturing exporter, and it views the 737 MAX as critical to its future. What's going on here now that has brought on this latest development?
Well, the ball is clearly in the FAA's court. The FAA has a new administrator who was recently appointed, who was not with the FAA during any of the certification of the MAX, and he's a former Delta Airlines 737 captain. I wonder if this is by accident. Sounds like a good choice to me. So at any rate, he has informed Boeing that the return of the MAX will be on the FAA schedule and not on Boeing's schedule. Now, the reason they shut down production, some cynics may say, would be to put pressure on the FAA to speed things up a little bit. But on the other hand, they've produced a total of 700 of these airplanes, 400 of which have never been delivered. They've just been parked all over the country waiting for the recertification. So we've got a real mess here, and it doesn't look like we're going to see this airplane back in the air until the spring.
Now, from the articles that I read, the articles made it appear as though the company made this decision, again, after this two-day board meeting. Explain, if you could, clarify the relationship between the FAA and Boeing's decision.
Well, as I say, the FAA is entirely in control of when the aircraft will be recertified. And Matt has told his staff and Boeing that they're in no hurry to do this. They want to make sure they have all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed and that everything is right and no mistakes will be made in the recertification of the aircraft. Apparently, there were some software glitches a couple of weeks ago that slowed things down. And we're really not sure of any other things specifically that are slowing it down, but it isn't happening very fast.
In fact, that takes me to my next question, because the investigators focused on the software system known as MCAS, which was created for the MAX and was found to have played a role in both the Ethiopian and Indonesian crashes. The plane has since been grounded. One article says that Boeing has not delivered a software fix for MCAS that has met federal approval. Now, a software fix for MCAS that has met federal approval, is that, to your point, because the FAA is being overly diligent, my word, not yours, or is there still a problem with the software, or a combination of the two?
The basic answer is I don't know for sure.
Okay.
I know that the system has been modified, and in my opinion, the things that they have done, had they been in place, would have prevented both of the accidents that occurred. They've made three changes. They're using two angle of attack sensors rather than just one.
Mm-hmm.
Push the nose down. It can only make one input, and the amount of input it made was very strong before. They've diminished that to the point where a pilot can easily, even if he follows the improper procedure or doesn't follow any procedure, he can easily override the MCAS now with just pressure on the control yoke. Had these things been in place on the accident aircraft, in my opinion, we would not have had these accidents.
Have you had a chance to do any simulator training or be in a simulator with this new with these software fixes, or do you know anyone personally that has been able to go into the simulator and test this out?
Well, Boeing has contacted me, and I think that before the airplanes return to service, I may very well get the opportunity to fly the corrected system. Apparently, all their simulators now will not replicate the accident scenario. All of them have been fixed to include these new modifications.
Wait a minute. Let me just get some clarification. When you say you hope in the near future to be able to fly, you mean actually physically get into the cockpit of a plane and fly it, as opposed to testing out the scenarios in a simulator?
Well, we discussed testing them out in the simulator. I don't know whether I'd get in an airplane to fly it or not.
Oh, that was the okay. That was my
simulator.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
So we'll see what happens. I'm quite sure that when the aircraft is recertified, it'll certainly be a lot better than it's been previously. The other thing is, the big takeaway from this whole issue is, I believe we're going to see the recertification process completely revised, so that the errors and omissions that took place that allowed the system to be designed in the way that it was and not be picked up previously should not occur again. So a big improvement in this area is certainly very welcome.
I was talking initially about the impact that this is having on the U.S. economy, but what many people may not realize is that this is having an international impact as well. The 737 MAX airliner, they've hit shares of U.K. and European suppliers to U.S. companies. So not only is this having an impact from a export perspective from the United States being able to deliver those 400 planes that are parked on tarmacs around the country, but it also has an import problem, as there are a number of suppliers for parts and engines that are not being purchased and being shipped to the United States.
Well, that's true. Now, the fuselages, about 70% of the MAX fuselages are actually made in Wichita by a company called Spirit. Now, that's about half of Spirit's business, and they employ 13,500 people, and they've got about 90 fuselages stored. So they certainly aren't going to need that workforce if they're not going to be producing fuselages. Boeing has 12,000 people in the Renton, Washington facility that assembles the aircraft. They're all being supposedly redeployed to different jobs in the Seattle area. But you have to wonder, if they're not producing any airplanes, how long can Boeing afford to keep 12,000 people on the payroll without a specific need for them? And if these people start to go away, when they begin to put the aircraft back into production, that's going to be another hiccup, because they may not have enough trained or experienced people, and they'll have to slow the production rate.
I mentioned in the opening that the 737 MAX was developed to compete with the European rival Airbus. And I've noticed, don't know if you have noticed this, I've noticed during particularly football games on Sundays, I've been seeing a lot more Airbus commercials, and they seem to be at least focusing on helicopters, but they're talking about the increase of manufacturing for Airbus in the United States. If these contracts start going over to Airbus, how hard is it for Boeing to reclaim that business? I'm thinking about soybean contracts for American farmers that were supposed to go to China that are now going to Brazil. Those markets will be hard to reclaim. How hard would it be for Boeing to reclaim the business that some airlines have now been sending to Airbus?
Well, with the good worldwide economy, basically, and a lot of demand, particularly in the third world, for airline service, both companies were really fully booked for a long time. So it isn't that Airbus can suddenly absorb the production that Boeing is losing. Their book of business is saturated. And I think that once production resumes again, we'll be filling a big void here. The airlines certainly need these airplanes. They were counting on them, and they don't have them. So I think what we're seeing in the travel industry is a shortage of airplanes, and consequently a shortage of enough capacity to fulfill the consumer demand. So we'll have to see where that goes.
In fact, touch on that a little more, elaborate on that a little more for me, because that was going to be my final question to you. I've been reading that now, at least on the domestic side, domestic airlines are canceling flights because they don't have these 737 MAXs in service to fill routes.
Well, that's true. And they also can't expand any routes. They can't go into new places. They can't provide enough capacity on some of the existing routes. Consequently, capacity is limited, and we have very crowded airplanes because of this limited capacity.
Gotcha. So basically, this is a matter of we got to wait and see what the FAA does as it relates to the software fixes that have been submitted, whether or not they'll approve them, how quickly they'll approve them. You know, you mentioned the simulation that they've taken the scenarios out of the simulators, if I understood what you said. They've taken the scenarios out of the simulators that would enable an individual such as yourself to test these problems. If they've taken them out of the simulators, how do we know if, in fact, the fixes are fixes?
Well, no, I'm sure that they are, because the things that they've done in the simulator required the sim be modified to show the fixed situation. I was interested in trying to have the same scenario as occurred in Indonesia,
right,
and then Ethiopia, just to see how I would react to it. But I was told that was not possible.
So I'm sorry for being obtuse here. I'm not understanding the answer. If you can't replicate that problem in a simulator, then how do you know that the problem has been fixed?
Well, what you do is you induce the problem in the simulator.
Oh!
And use the new software to solve the problem.
So the problem can still be induced. That's what I was missing.
Yes, the problem can be, it can be induced.
Okay. Now, thank you, Keith Mackey. Now I understand your point. Very clear, as always. It's my slow end, not catching up to your fast end. So Keith Mackey, president of Mackey International, thank you so much for your time. As always, greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
You're welcome, Dr. Leon. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.